This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website. Great, we're nearly there. Lunch beckons for those of you looking famished in the room. Before we move on to our next panel, can we all just thank Clodagh Rice for that brilliant, taking us through the last 2.5 hours? It's very good of her. Just feel next time you're feeling kind of, oh, that journalist didn't say what I wanted them to say, just remember what she said to you about trying to explain the fiscal framework in 30 seconds. Unless you're doing the job, guys, you can't judge. Which brings me, so we heard from John earlier a great reflection on 25 years of devolution and what that's meant for politics and for policy making. It's quite a hard act to follow, but we've got the one other person in who've lived experience of running a devolved administration who can do so. So next we're going to hear from Mark Drakeford, who was First Minister of Wales between 2018 and 2024. And before that was lucky enough to be the Cabinet Secretary for Finance. So obviously the Resolution Foundation are keen at this point. He did the economic side of things too, but even more exciting, what's better than public services and economic policy? But someone who also had an experience before that as an academic working as a professor of social policy and social science. This is basically what dreams look like in Resolution Foundation land. And actually, I'm semi-joking, but there aren't many politicians who... Most politicians faced with kind of people like us with charts, and not all, any of you watching, not you, obviously, don't tend to say when they disagree. And one of the great things about Mark is when he disagrees with you, politely, obviously, he tells you, and then even better, he tells you why, because he's actually thought about it. So Wales has been very lucky to have him. I've always benefited from hearing from him. So Mark's going to give us his reflections on the devolution experience, and then we're going to open up for questions as we did before. So Mark, over to you.
Well, Torsten, diolch yn fawr am y wahoddiad unwaith eto I siarad gyda'r Foundation. Thank you very much once again for the chance to be with the Resolution Foundation. I'm planning on only doing two things. As ever, you sit and listen to others and feel I could have torn all this up and written something completely different about other interesting aspects of that devolution journey. But for today, just two aspects for me. I'm going to say something about the history of devolution, about the constitutional settlement, about where we are today and the future of the United Kingdom and small things like that. And underneath that big blanket, I am going to focus a bit more on the economy, the history of the economy over the last 25 years, the things that have gone reasonably well, the things that are clearly still to do and so on. So I'm going to start with a bigger picture. So 25 years ago exactly to today, some of us were out there on the mean streets of Cardiff bothering people in their own homes, as politicians have to do, because the election was just a few days away. And the background to that first election in Wales was so different to the background in Scotland that I thought I ought to just start with that, because the Scottish experience was of a huge campaign, you know, a convention, the involvement of civic society, and huge public enthusiasm for devolution. The position in Wales was very different. We scraped through the referendum in the middle of the night when Carmarthen, my own home county, I'm pleased to say, voted in favour of devolution. And that hesitant start, that uncertain, hesitant start, was very much the shaping experience of those early days. Apologies to those of you who I've told this story before, but it seems to me to illustrate something. A good friend in the very early days of devolution was Professor Scott Greer, who was a Canadian researcher in Canada these days, in the UK at the time, and Scott's area was health policy, and he used to tell a story of delivering a lecture. He delivered the same lecture on Monday night in Edinburgh, and he delivered the identical lecture in Cardiff on the following evening. And the title of the lecture was to do with public health. Public health, Scotland is good, but Wales is better. And what he used to say was, he wasn't believed in either place. Okay. A Scottish audience couldn't believe that they were not in first place, and a Welsh audience couldn't believe that they were in first place. And that just tells you something, I think, about that hesitant, very early days. And the history, really, and probably the most remarkable thing about Welsh devolution, is how an institution that was very narrowly supported, had an incredibly difficult first year, has finally found itself in a position where it is a completely taken for granted part of the constitutional landscape in Wales. And not only is the institution taken for granted, but the model is taken for granted as well. I have been asked countless times, one of the least interesting questions that I'm asked is, isn't Wales indeed curious? And the reason it's not an interesting question is because it patently isn't true. And if you want to see the lived example of that, in our last elections, 3 years ago now in 2021, the choice was absolutely explicitly in front of voters in Wales. You had an abolish the Assembly party, with all the advantages of a proportional system and led by people who'd been in the Senedd for the previous 5 years, the, what was left of the sort of UKIP surge. So 5 years of the platform that that provides, the system that allows relatively minority views to have their expression in the Senedd, and not a single one of them was elected. At the other end of the spectrum, Plaid Cymru, which has slightly played fast and loose with independence over the years. Sometimes it's, we're big believers in Wales, and we've probably even independence down here somewhere. In 2021, independence was front and centre of the Plaid Cymru campaign. Vote for us for an independent Wales. And Plaid Cymru had their worst result in any election since 1999. And the Labour Party, which continues to stand on the belief of strong and entrenched devolution in a successful United Kingdom, we had our best result in 20 years, despite the fact of having been in government for the whole of that period. So the remarkable question, I think, is not, is Wales interested in independence, but why, with all its imperfections and its hesitations, why does the Welsh public remain so attached to that original 99 model? And one of the reasons, I think, that it continues to command the support of people in Wales is because devolution has been a journey. Because the Senedd today is very different to the Senedd of 1999. I was lucky enough to arrive in the year 2000 and have been there more or less ever since. And it is literally true that in those early days, the Senedd would debate the smaller Egyptian potato order because there wasn't an awful lot else to talk about. Today, the Senedd is a primary lawmaking institution. It makes the laws for Wales in devolved areas. It has fiscal responsibilities alongside the other responsibilities that it exercises. It's a very different place. And I think the journey has been important in continuing to secure the support of people in Wales to that underpinning model. That model has been under the greatest strain since 2019. That is the fault line in Welsh politics. Scotland will be different in that way, but the real fault line in Welsh politics is the election for the first time in the history of devolution of a Conservative government in London with a considerable majority and a very different view of the United Kingdom, not simply to the Labour Party, but to other governments led by Conservative prime ministers. So my own assessment of this is that the constitutional future of the United Kingdom may be a suppressed crisis. It is not at the acute end that it was maybe only a couple of years ago, but there remains, I believe, a present danger to the continuation of the United Kingdom, and that the greatest risk to it is that hubristic feeling among some parts of the political spectrum that somehow this is a problem that's all over. It is certainly not. If it doesn't receive attention, then what is a suppressed crisis today has every opportunity to become a crisis on the surface of the United Kingdom in a relatively short order. And I'll return to a tiny bit of that at the very end. I said I was going to focus on issues to do with economics and the economic record. And that's, of course, because this is the Resolution Foundation, and the Foundation has been one of the very few voices which has been prepared to make the Welsh experience the focus of serious study. And the 2020 report that was produced by the Foundation on Welsh economic prospects and Welsh economic experience says itself that that experience has been too often overlooked by other analysts. I'm going to focus on the whole on some positives. I do that not because there are not very real challenges and areas where we would have wished to have done better, but I focus on the positives because you can be sure that the other aspects will always come up in any set of questions. So here are four, a modest set of them. And the first is to do with employment. If you lived in Wales in the 1990s, what you witnessed was a growing employment gap between Wales and the rest of the United Kingdom. It was a persistent gap, but it was a growing gap. The impact of the 1980s and the forced closures of large parts of heavy industry in Wales were absolutely still being felt in employment rates, and especially in levels of people outside the workplace altogether, economic inactivity. That gap has halved in the 20 years of devolution. And over significant periods of more recent years, the employment rate in Wales has been higher than the United Kingdom. The unemployment rate has been lower than across the United Kingdom. And the inroads into economic inactivity, setting aside for a moment, although it's got a big set aside, the impact of the pandemic and the more recent history, has, I think, well exceeded any expectations that people would have had at the start of devolution. If you'd said to people in 1999, within 20 years, you will have halved those gaps, not just, you know, arrested the growing nature of the gap, but reversed it, I think people would have thought you were being very ambitious indeed. So my second point is about productivity, which, as we know, is the single biggest challenge facing the UK economy, and it's a very real challenge in parts of the Welsh economy, not in manufacturing, but in the service sector particularly. But despite the challenges, an analysis that PricewaterhouseCoopers produced just 6 months ago concluded that over the last decade, 2011 to 2021, Wales had seen the highest productivity growth of any UK region or nation other than Northern Ireland. A 9.7% increase over that single decade. Now, productivity levels in large parts of the Welsh economy remain suppressed, below where they need to be. The struggle to improve them is not easy, but the picture is still of a level of improvement that's not been matched anywhere in Britain and has been exceeded only in Northern Ireland. I wanted to thirdly pick up some of the debates I could hear going on about, you know, GVA, GDP. Wales remains towards the bottom of the UK league table in both of those ways of measuring the economy. But there is a different story to be told if you look at figures for gross disposable income per household. So the actual money that actual people have in their pockets to spend. Here, the devolution period has seen a strong convergence between Wales and the United Kingdom. Median Welsh household income is around 4% lower than that of the United Kingdom as a whole. It was 7% at the start of devolution. And I'm going to say something in a minute about why money in the pockets of Welsh households doesn't reflect the wider gaps in GVA and GDP that you might have expected. Well, finally, I want to say something about equality. Now, you've heard already from Jonathan about the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. Of its 7 goals, surely the most radical and ambitious is that it has a goal for Wales to be a more equal country. And I remember very vividly the discussion in the cabinet when the goals were being signed off, because civil servants had produced a draft that committed Wales to having a goal of equality of opportunity. And, you know, it was, on the whole, a relatively rare discussion in cabinet, which was about politics and ideology and about the ambitions that you have as a political party. And that was the reason why the goal is not equality of opportunity. It is about equality of income. It is about wanting a society in which the gap between people who have to worry every single week about what they will eat and how they will pay for the most basic things, how the gap between people who have that experience can be narrowed between those people who have more than they will ever know what to do with. The PricewaterhouseCoopers report to which I referred said that Wales prioritises the fair distribution of income and wealth significantly more than any other region. Well, I'll forgive the word region for a minute. But the sentiment, I think, is an important one. And it's the Resolution Foundation work that shows that income inequality gaps in Wales are lower than across the United Kingdom as a whole, and that inequality gaps within Wales have narrowed, despite the headwinds created by a decade of austerity. And that narrowing is seen across the inequality gaps, the gaps in employment, in pay, in incomes, and in productivity. And those gaps have closed the most where the original gap was greatest. So I think on those tests as well, on the tests of employment, productivity, household disposable income, and equality, there is a positive case to be made for the economic experience of living in Wales over the last 25 years. I don't have time to do more than just to headline some of the reasons why I think that has been possible. I'm going to say a little bit more about one, because if there is a single story that unites every administration across that 25-year period in Wales, it is the pursuit of the social wage, as Barbara Castle would have said. Those things that we can do collectively, which if we do them collectively, leave more money in the pockets of our fellow citizens for them to decide what to do with for themselves. Or to use that wonderful term from the Beveridge report, to leave more money to fructify in the pockets of our fellow citizens. Now, what are the things that we have been able to do that rely on collective provision? That means that the citizen doesn't have to pay for those things themselves. Well, it's a long list, and I'm only going to give you a few of them. A very early one was to introduce free travel on public transport for people aged over 60 and people with disabilities. The provision of free prescriptions was an early decision. It's been there now for over 20 years. In Wales, there's no tax on income, or on illness, rather, in that way. The expansion of education maintenance allowances, abolished in England, retained in Wales. The amount you get as a young person increased as well. The creation of a pupil deprivation grant, a grant to assist families with the cost of the school day. You know, we started it with just one school year. You got this help in the first year your child went to secondary school. Then we doubled it to 2 years, then we doubled it to 4 years, and now you get it every year. Every single year your child is of compulsory school age, you will get a sum of money from the Welsh Government to assist you with the fact that going to school is an expensive business. And if you've got nothing much to start with, a very expensive business indeed. We have in Wales retained both the council tax benefit and our version of the social fund, you know, the safety net of the last resort, where it is a national scheme, a rules-based scheme funded directly by the Welsh taxpayer. And just to give one example from the current Senedd term, of course, we are still in the middle of a pilot of a universal basic income programme, where every single care leaver in Wales over the period of the programme will receive a sum of money equivalent to the real living wage, unconditionally, as of right, to do what they like with, in the belief that those young people will make investment decisions that will put them on a track to a better future and avoid very expensive public expenditure dealing with the consequences of failure, where we haven't been able to help those most vulnerable young people in our society. If you add all of that up, and some other things as well, then a not untypical Welsh household will have £2,000 in their pockets over a year that otherwise they would have to find for themselves. And that's one of the reasons why that disposable income per household issue is so important to us in Wales. None of those figures are taken into account in the figures I gave you earlier. The ONS doesn't recognise them as part of our calculation. But you put that in there as well, and the actual money you have to spend in Wales as a household, I think the gap between the UK level and the Welsh level is even narrower than I suggested to you earlier. Why else? What are the other things that have helped us on that journey? Well, without a doubt, the impact of European Union investment. The reason why the Welsh economy grew faster than the UK economy and grew even faster in Objective 1 areas was because of the way in which we were able to use that European Union investment. Investment in skills, David talked about that earlier. Qualification level, skill qualification levels amongst the working age population in Wales has risen substantially in the decade beyond 2008. The underpinning impact of the Social Partnership approach, the Social Partnership Act that makes the social partnership model a statutory feature of life in Wales. Jonathan talked to you about the 50 well-being indicators that we have in Wales. We're the only part, I would guess, of the United Kingdom that has a growth in trade union membership as one of the positive indicators of well-being health. So, you know, we positively want to encourage, we have the largest proportion of our workforce in trade unions already, and we think if we can get more people in there, that strengthens our social partnership model. The success of the Development Bank of Wales, astoundingly more successful than the British Bank, although that is in much earlier days. And then the focus on the foundational economy that you heard about as well. Challenges remain as high as ever. Leaving the European Union has a particularly sharp impact on Wales because we have a higher proportion of our economy in manufacturing and in the agriculture sector, all now facing new barriers to trade and additional barriers practically every day. We have the impact of austerity and underinvestment. Demography is an issue for us in Wales. We have a higher part of our population that is aged over 65, over 75, over 85, and uniquely in the United Kingdom, we're a net importer of older people people come to Wales when they're 65. And, you know, that has its challenges as well as the richness that they bring and the continuing focus on. And in this way, we are very aligned with the Resolution Foundation's recent work on the paradox of high inequality and low economic growth. And, you know, I'm not here today at all to say that Wales doesn't display both of those features in a way that we would like to be able to do more. John Swinney, I know, and I was grateful to John for his sharing with me the script of what he was to say to you today, argues that it's impossible to divorce the economic record and the constitutional settlement, and I agree with that, but I don't follow the line that the SNP would then take in arguing that because the current settlement is unstable and vulnerable, that independence is the best way to find a new foundation for economic success in the future. I started by saying that the constitutional position within the United Kingdom remains one, which is a crisis, albeit a suppressed crisis. What Wales needs and what the United Kingdom needs, if we are to continue to succeed together, is to be found in the roadmaps which are available to an incoming Labour government. It's there in the Brown report, it's there in the Constitutional Convention report that we commissioned in Wales, and that is entrenched devolution that can be defended against a rogue government of the sort that we have had since 2019, and which sees devolution not simply as a project for Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, but has an English dimension to it as well, and makes that sense of a dispersed power, and I would argue, a dispersed sovereignty that goes alongside it, a central rather than a peripheral way in which we organise both the United Kingdom and the economy that goes alongside it. Diolch yn fawr.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark. That was predictably great. Thank you very much indeed for that. What, when we were talking to John earlier and we started off with 25 years ago. So why don't we start there, given that you started there as well. And does it, why was Wales such a reluctant devolver compared to the, I don't want to overdo, everybody in Scotland was enthusiastic, but definitely there'd been a strong build-up over, you know, 15 years beforehand. So why was Wales so different back then?
Well, my predecessor, Rodri Morgan, used to say when I couldn't stop him, I would try to stop him when I could.
very honest of you.
he would say the problem was that in Wales we are pathologically modest. Now, he meant it both as a compliment.
Okay.
We are not of the sort of, you know, boosterism, breast-beating school of national identity. But sometimes that can topple over into a form of lack of self-belief in your ability to take control of your own affairs. And if you look at what was said by people who opposed devolution, not just in that referendum, but in subsequent referendum in 2010, the narrative was all about, oh, they'll never manage. Oh, they'll never be able to do it. Oh, they won't have any ideas. If they have any ideas, they won't be able to make them work. And even if they can make them work, they won't succeed in making any difference. It was all that sort of, you know, irredeemably negative sense that people in Wales were somehow incapable of taking responsibility for their own futures and making a success of it. And, you know, if we had that referendum in 1997, which was very narrowly won, we had a further referendum in 2010, which was on taking primary lawmaking powers, and that was overwhelmingly passed. And I remember Rodri saying to me at the end of that, he said to me, well, my political task is done. You know, in a decade, we have persuaded people in Wales that an institution about which they were very uncertain to get to a position where they think it is an institution that is not only central to everyday life, but where they wanted to have more responsibility for the way in which Wales is governed.
And what changed their mind over 10 years? And are they any longer pathologically humble?
What changed over the period, I think, is just the experience of it. The first year, as I said to you, was an incredibly difficult year. Three of the four party leaders that started that year didn't win there at the end of it.
It's a song-like attrition rate.
Yes, indeed. And the Senate, the Assembly as it was, spent its whole time looking inwards and debating about how it itself was going to survive. What changed was the arrival of Roderick Morgan as the First Minister, the formation of a partnership government with the Liberal Democrats that gave a working majority to that first period. And remarkably, in the winter of the year 2000, a series of biblical-like plagues happened in Wales. And it became clear that already, when those things happened, when there was flooding, when there was a fuel crisis, when foot and mouth hit, I've forgotten the fourth F, a plague of frogs, fuel. It was something. People looked to the Assembly as the place where they expected a response to that difficulty to be organised. And that's when the corner, I felt, was properly turned.
So do you think it's changed Wales, as well as changing attitudes to the Assembly and government?
Well, I think it has. I think the pandemic, which you may have talked about a bit, is a second big moment in all of that, when it becomes clear to people who actually hadn't realised for 20 years where some of the decisions that are now being made, that they were being made in Wales, and just the profile of the institution and its significance in people's lives became of a different sort of order.
Very good. Can we talk a bit about political culture? Because you said that there are lots of differences between the Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish experience. But one of the things that makes Wales stand out is obviously that the same party has been running the show, admittedly in different forms, but has been running the show for 25 years. Reasonably, we're boasting about the recent result, which is surprising in some ways for an incumbent party over such a length of time. But how does that affect the political culture? And how do you feel like it's changed over those 25 years?
Well, I think we've learned two things, at least, in 25 years.
Only two?
Well, I mention them because I think they're things that have not been learnt at all at the UK level.
Okay.
The first is that a proportional election system is good for you. So without a proportional election system, Labour would have been in untrammelled power in Wales, with no sense at all amongst opposition parties that there was a chance that they may have an opportunity to share them in that. That would have been very corrosive, I think, of political culture. And the fact that Labour's never actually won a majority. We have 30 seats at the moment out of 60. You can't pass a budget on 30 seats. You can't pass legislation on 30 seats. You've got to work with somebody else. So that's the second thing we've learnt, is that working with other parties is not a failure of democracy. Now, in London, it seems to me, there's a huge antipathy to proportional representation. People would rather lose power than share power, astonishingly to me here. And also that if you do have to work with another party because, a strange result throws that up, that is somehow a terrible aberration and a failure of politics. Whereas what I think we have learnt in Wales is both that proportional forms of representation, even when they send you people you'd rather not be seeing, actually that is a strength, and that the fact that you have to work across party boundaries to form an administration, that progressive parties are capable. It's not easy, it's very hard work, it takes hours and hours of talking and energy and so on, but in the end it allows you to do things at the progressive end of politics that otherwise you couldn't do. And I think both of those lessons remain very unlearned here, And I think we have learnt them both in Wales.
Great. Let's do a bit on relationships for the Welsh Government to the UK Government and to the other devolved administration. So one of the popular questions online, which will appear here, is just, now, we don't want to prejudge things. Politics is very unstable. We've learnt that in the last few hours. Assuming that the polls look remotely right, there'll be a Labour government at some point, presumably a Labour government anyway at some point, due to the whole democracy thing. But how will that change things, do you think?
Well, that will change things very fundamentally from a Welsh government's point of view. So I've lived through both halves. You know, it's a game of two halves in Wales. We had the first half where we had a Labour government in London, and we've had a longer second half, if you can have a longer half, where we've had to deal with a different sort of government. So to return to a position where we have political colleagues in London, where we will be, you know, approaching problems from a basically shared perspective, and where, as I hope, there is a ready-made prospectus for that incoming government to put right some of the constitutional flaws that have been so badly exposed in the last 5 years, that will change things in a fundamental way. Will we agree on everything? Of course we won't. Will there be tensions? Of course there will. You know, at the end of that very first term of Labour government in Wales, Rodri delivered what is probably the most remembered lecture of any First Minister, when he gave his clear red water speech. And, you know, it was designed to show that Labour in Wales was different to Labour in London, and that's been very much part of our political success as well. So it will be fundamentally different and fundamentally better, but it will still have, and I think creatively and importantly, some grit in the oyster.
Very good. And then what about with other devolved administrations? How what's your experience of those relations over your time, and maybe if that's changed over time at all?
Well, I think we've worked very closely with the Scottish governments. I'm been very glad to do that. We've agreed generally on more things than we've disagreed. We disagree, of course, on a very fundamental thing, and that does have a shaping influence on the conversation. But on many of the things that we've talked about today, that basic social democratic tradition that I think animates politics in Wales has animated politics in Scotland as well. Our relations with Northern Ireland have also been, I think, very warm and very positive, and we've hugely missed having Northern Ireland around the table in so many of those intra-government discussions. And it's not just a loss to Northern Ireland when they are not there, it's a loss to Wales when they're not there as well, because, you know, in the very asymmetric nature of the United Kingdom, when you have one very big and very powerful component, sometimes the ability to work with others on things that may look different to us than they do from an English perspective has been very important. And not having our Northern Ireland colleagues in the room has been to their detriment, I'm quite sure of that, but to ours as well. And it is great to see them back as an executive.
It definitely is. Maybe a Labour, maybe Labour politicians do talk about them as social democrats proactively, but I don't hear it often, whereas you do. And you talk about the 25 years as a country run on social democrat lines broadly. You talk about the social wage. You definitely don't hear as much talk about that in London at the moment. So here's one of the puzzles for people looking at it, which is the experience, again, I'm looking at the whole period, not just your time in as First Minister, which is social democrats in charge in different ways across that whole period, but not the scale of tax rises that people would normally associate, or you may say unfairly, but maybe associate with the social democrat model. Why didn't we see that, do you think, over the 25 years?
Wales has very modest fiscal responsibilities. We have only really three taxes, landfill disposal tax, stamp duty land tax, as it would be called here, and income tax. And truthfully, the income tax varying powers we have are unusable. I believe that from the very beginning. I gave evidence to the Silk Commission, which lay behind them, arguing with them that if that's what they concluded, they were giving Wales a set of powers that would never be used.
And remind everyone why it's unusable?
Because the ability to vary is very, very narrowly constrained. We don't have the bands capacity that they do in Scotland, which has been part of their ability to make a difference. We can move it up or down a little bit compared to England. And, you know, we have peered over that precipice fairly regularly. And
yep.
Every time you conclude, it's just not doable. So it's there as an entirely theoretical power, it seems to me. There were other taxes that could have been devolved where we would have made greater use of them,
yep.
I believe. But the Scott Commission chose income tax variation. I'm afraid the history has, I think, borne out the fact that it's there in theory and it's unusable, unworkable in practice.
Which I think some people would say the early years of Scottish devolution also
made
their case for that being the
position.
Council tax was anything I was going to raise.
Yep.
Which we didn't get to discuss in the first session, but if people were the keen fiscal reformers in the room, which there are some, it's not their fault, they can get help for that. They would say at least Wales has managed some progress on council tax. Some, not as much as maybe some people hoped, but some. Where are you on the glass half full versus glass half empty? We didn't deal with it.
We are the only part of the United Kingdom that has had council tax revaluation during the devolution period, and we have been working very closely with the IFS in more recent times to try to make the council tax fairer. This is my view and the Welsh Government's view. There is a limit to how fair you can make an inherently unfair tax. Now, we want to do that, and we've done it in a series of ways. You can't be imprisoned in Wales anymore for not paying the council tax, and you could be until just a few years ago. You don't pay council tax if you're a care leaver in Wales. We've done far more, I think, than most other places to make sure that category of help you can get for what's not in today's terms called severe mental impairment. We have already made a series of erosions into the unfair nature of the tax. We want to do more. It is not easy because any change that creates losers as well as winners tends to hear a lot from the emailing classes and not so much from...
emailing classes, others. I've never heard that. Have they stopped chattering? Then it's email.
They're emailing, yes.
Okay, fine.
I think that is a
thank you for the update on the political culture.
And alongside that, we have been doing some very serious work on land value taxation. And have continued to do that work during this Senate term. And, I hear what everybody always says, that land value taxation is one of those things that always looks good on paper and nobody's ever managed to do it successfully in practice. But I still think myself that, my fondness for devolution is not as a set of league tables between parts of the United Kingdom, but as a ability to have policy experimentation, the living laboratory view of devolution. And I think Wales is well placed to try to be a bit of a living laboratory for how a land value approach to taxation might work.
Let's just wrap up on one area, which is public services, slightly more generally. So if you went back to the early 2000s and people said, what were the things that you'd want to achieve in Wales? So lots of them would be the similar things on, health service and education. There probably was a view then that more radical change to local government than has happened would have been high up the list, but maybe on my memory of the mid-2000s is flawed. So on which of these areas do you think progress has been made against what people would have expected or hoped, even Labour administrators would have hoped, versus have just proved too difficult in a devolved setting?
Well, I think local government reorganisation, as it was conceptualised then, did require more political capital than there was there to be expended. But what we have done, and it's much less visible, but it's, I think, in the end, will be much more effective, is that we have moved far more local authority services into regional models with shared governance amongst the local authorities that cover those than you would ever have seen back then. So,
just remind everyone, this means rather than merging the entire... local authorities.
You create this is not the term using the app, but a single board in which social services for, let's say, five local authorities are planned and delivered on a common footprint, rather than every one of them having their own social services department with its own director and its own... So that approach to local government reform, I think, has been doable, and I think in many ways will achieve more than a sort of forced merger would have done. Just two very last points. And the thing that is most difficult for Welsh public services is the thing that is most difficult for public services everywhere. It is 14 years of underinvestment. You know, in Wales, as everywhere else, satisfaction levels in our health service reached their height in 2010, you know, higher than any time in the history of the NHS. Yes. And that's because we'd had a decade of sustained incremental investment where we were able to put things in place and do the things we wanted to do. 14 years of the opposite means that our public services today, all of them, are characterised by enormous pressures and, you know, not having the resource that's needed to meet those. So that is an ongoing struggle.
Yep.
On the other side of the coin, for me, I think in Wales all the way through, we have had a stronger sense of how, when it comes to essential public services, ownership matters. And, you know, I hope that that will be a lesson for the coming period, that when you are talking about fundamental things that you cannot do without, the idea that you organise those on a market basis, where you allow profits to be taken out of those fundamental services, that is not the way to organise them. Now, we have a Welsh Water Company, which is a not-for-profit distribution company, and while it has some performance challenges, it certainly doesn't have any of the challenges that you would see in Thames.
It was quite hard. It'd be quite hard to load up on billions of debt as a.
It doesn't have all of that. But in other places too, one of the things that I'm looking forward to a lot in the coming weeks is that we will put a bill in front of the Senedd to abolish the extraction of private profit from services for looked after children in Wales. And if you look at the Monopoly and Mergers Commission, two reports in recent times showing how extractive profit has been in the care of the most vulnerable children in our society, where the state is that child's parent. You think of some, you know, moments that remain with you always. I met a young woman, 14 years old, brought to me in a delegation of children by the then Children's Commissioner, who told me how she had seen herself up on a website where her local authority had invited companies to put in the lowest bid to look after her. Now, just think about that for a moment. You are a 14-year-old child. Your family circumstances have been so difficult that the state has stepped in to take over your care. And you decide to discharge that responsibility by putting that child up for auction. That will not happen again in Wales.
That's a powerful case. Right, let's wrap up on two questions, only the first one of which is a serious one. So you started and ended a bit on whether you want to call it unstable settlement or suppressed crisis, the two phrases. In 10 years' time, where are we going to be? Are we going to have resolved the... So we're going to unsuppress it, hopefully by not having the crisis, but by removing it, or where are we going to be in 10 years?
I can tell you I'd like to be. I can't promise you that we would be there. We would have done some very basic things like, you know, abolished the House of Lords and replaced it with a Parliament of the Nations and the Regions, with particular responsibility for constitutional matters and protecting the Constitution. We would have heard no more about parliamentary sovereignty, a great myth of our times, but one which allows Westminster politicians to treat devolution as though it were a toy on the end of a piece of string, where you edge a bit more out and you pull it back when you don't like what they do with it. We would have recognised the fact that already in the United Kingdom, sovereignty is dispersed to the four nations. And what we would have would be a radically federalist model in which we disperse power and then agree to pool it back together again for those common purposes that we would agree we would do better together. And, you know, for me, as someone who believes in the United Kingdom, that's quite a list of things. You know, I don't want a Welsh Navy or a Welsh Air Force. I don't want Welsh embassies around the world. So foreign affairs, defence, macroeconomic policy, social security policy, for me, I would choose to pool much of our sovereignty back. But that would be the model. not everything is held in Westminster, you know, and to varying degrees it gets dispersed. Everything is dispersed to begin with.
And then the crisis would have been...
And then we pull it back.
Yep.
And I think that would give you a stable model for a United Kingdom that people would want to belong to. And that's the thing that I think has been missing so much of the debate. Who is making the case for the United Kingdom? Not a fearful case, not a case that says, oh, it'll be dreadful if you leave, or, you know, we're not going to give you a pathway to leaving. There's no long-term future in that. You have to make a case for the United Kingdom, the positive case that said the people in every part of the United Kingdom would say, well, that's a place I'd like to belong to.
Very good. Well, I feel like bad ruining that with the frivolous question now, but I'm not saying this was the main thing I was thinking while you were talking, but I was wondering what was the Egyptian potato order?
Wow.
Which is making me feel really shallow because you've just given that rallying cry for a bit. But I do want to know what the Egyptian potato order was.
Well, you didn't quite recollect the whole
thing
because it was the smaller Egyptian potato.
Are there larger ones?
Yes.
Okay.
It wasn't any Egyptian
okay.
potato.
Sorry.
It was a set of rules about what regulations applied to a potato coming from Egypt, depending upon the size of it.
Okay. Right, okay. I feel chastened by in every sense. Right, can we all thank Mark for his brilliant thoughts today? I also want to thank all of you for coming this morning. I hope it's been interesting, and to thank all of our speakers, in particular Gordon Rice. And I also want to thank the team at the Resolution Foundation and at PolicyWise for making today happen. There aren't enough of these kind of sessions, so it's great that we've managed to make this happen. And all of you should go out, and the whole point of today is that you keep learning. But first of all, you can keep learning by eating some lunch and chatting about it upstairs. So have a good lunch, everyone. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.